Welcome to SCOTUSCast, U.S. Citizens and Foreign Surveillance Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 29, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Clapper v. Amnesty International USA. This case concerns Congress's 2008 amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which expanded the federal government's power to engage in electronic surveillance of foreign nationals. In theory, this enhanced surveillance may inadvertently pick up communications with U.S. citizens. The question before the court is whether U.S. groups and individuals who contend that these amendments exceed Congress's authority, but who have submitted no proof demonstrating that the communications would actually be captured by the enhanced surveillance, have standing to bring their challenge in court. To discuss the case, we have Megan Brown, who is a partner at Wiley Ryan LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Brown.
In Clapper v. Amnesty International, the Supreme Court confronts another high-profile national security case. Clapper is a challenge to the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, which authorized expanded surveillance of overseas targets. But the Supreme Court will not decide the merits of the challenge, which was dismissed below for lack of standing. The question before the court now is whether a group of plaintiffs can bring a facial challenge to FISA amendments based on their allegations that it permits overly broad warrantless surveillance in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Plaintiffs also claim that the act chills speech in violation of the First Amendment and violates the separation of powers by limiting judicial review of surveillance requests. Plaintiffs are a group of individuals and organizations, including attorneys and journalists, who filed suit on the day the president signed the act in July of 2008. The act was passed with strong bipartisan support and was hailed by the intelligence community as providing needed clarification and authority with respect to overseas targets. Plaintiffs admit they cannot, by law, be the target of surveillance under the act. Nonetheless, they claim they have standing to challenge the act based on their subjective fear that their overseas communications may be incidentally intercepted, should FISA surveillance be authorized for one of their overseas contacts. They point to avoidance measures they have taken or may take to protect their communications from this feared surveillance, as well as the claimed chilling effect of the law on their and others' communications. They filed in the district court a series of declarations from attorneys and journalists who say their activities have been impacted by these fears. They emphasized as well attorneys' ethical obligations to preserve confidences, which they argue makes the avoidance measures more reasonable and relevant to the standing inquiry. Plaintiffs moved for summary judgment, and the United States cross-moved, arguing that the plaintiffs lacked standing and defending the act's constitutionality. The Southern District of New York dismissed the case for lack of Article III standing, but the Second Circuit reversed, finding the speculation about surveillance and the avoidance measures alleged to be reasonable and sufficient to satisfy Article III. The Second Circuit denied the government's request for rehearing en banc, despite the vigorous dissent of six judges. The dissenting judges protested that the panel's decision was at odds with Supreme Court precedent and would expand the universe of harms on which suit could be predicated, both in the national security context and beyond. The United States thereafter sought certiorari. The United States argued that the Second Circuit's holding is unprecedented and inconsistent with cases that require proof of a non-conjectural and imminent injury in fact, and that reject self-imposed injuries stemming from a plaintiff's fears concerning defendant's future actions. They argue that there's no concrete imminent injury alleged that is, quote, certainly impending, and also that plaintiffs fail the redressability prong of the standing inquiry because they can't show that this particular statute subjects them to surveillance that they otherwise would not be subject to under statutes or authorities not challenged in the lawsuit. 10 amicus briefs were filed in support of the plaintiffs from a range of groups like the Reporters Committee for a Free Press and former members of the Church Committee. They invoke the need for judicial redress of constitutional questions and the specter of unlawful or excessive government surveillance. One amicus brief was filed in support of the government on behalf of six former attorneys general from the Carter, Reagan, and Bush administrations. I wrote that brief with the Washington Legal Foundation. Amici in support of the United States emphasize the fact-specific nature of Fourth Amendment claims, which are not ordinarily thought of as suitable for facial challenges. In sum, plaintiffs ask a federal court to invalidate the statute under the Fourth Amendment without confirmation of particular activities or specifics about what surveillance may or may not actually be going on. While the plaintiffs are right that such confirmation may be unavailable due to the state secrets doctrine and the classified nature of the challenged activity, as noted in a footnote in the United States briefing, this does not change the nature of the inquiry before a federal court. Without specifics, that court cannot evaluate the importance and relative value of actual government activities or the party's reasonable expectations of privacy in this setting. This makes the desired declaratory ruling simply an advisory opinion about the legality of possible surveillance activities. The United States and its amici argue that proper application of the standing doctrine is critical when it comes to national security litigation. If allowed to proceed, such litigation distracts and disrupts the government's ability to perform its duties. The standing question has ramifications beyond the government, too. High-ranking government officials are often sued in their personal capacity after service concludes, and private companies helping the government also face the threat of litigation filed to affect government policy. The United States and amici argue that Article III standing must be strictly enforced to prevent unnecessary and disruptive litigation over policy disputes. Oral argument in Clapper took place recently on October 29th. At argument, several justices focused on who might have standing under the government's view and whether that was adequate to provide for judicial review of alleged surveillance activity. The government emphasized that the statute provides standing to service providers and those targeted for prosecution to challenge particular aspects of surveillance under the Act. Some justices, including Justices Ginsburg and Kagan, were clearly troubled by the possibility that plaintiffs would never know if they were subject to incidental interception and therefore never be able to bring suit. Other justices, notably Justice Scalia, pointed to precedent that the absence of someone with standing might signal that the question is committed to the political branches by the separation of powers. Resolution of this case thus may turn in part on the satisfaction of the justices with the available avenues for review, or their comfort with the possibility that review may be lacking in many or all circumstances. Prominent at argument also was the allegedly unique situation attorneys find themselves in. Justice Kagan in particular focused questioning of Solicitor General Verrilli on the circumstances of attorney plaintiffs who she viewed as taking reasonable precautions to protect the confidentiality of communications in the face of possibly expanded government surveillance. General Verrilli argued that it was the ethics rules and not the FISA authority that caused the attorney to take the measures described. When the plaintiff's attorney was questioned about this, Chief Justice Roberts noted that the sort of confidentiality concerns articulated are present in any area of practice, and noted that responsible attorneys routinely avoid certain communications with potential targets of law enforcement. Similarly, Justice Alito asked whether a mob attorney would have standing to challenge the Wiretap Act because of the possibility of surveillance of his clients. Mr. Jaffer, for the respondents, responded that this statute makes them especially concerned about the communications they are engaged in with people overseas. But he did concede that under his theory, the mob attorney would also have standing to challenge laws authorizing wiretaps. Other justices, including Justice Kennedy, were skeptical of the notion they found implicit in the Solicitor General's argument that the United States is not, in fact, using these authorities as fully as described by the plaintiffs. As Justice Kennedy said to General Verrilli, "It's hard for me to think that the government isn't using all of the powers at its command under the law." General Verrilli pushed back on that construction of his argument, saying instead that it is not about whether the authorities are being used, but that in order for there to be an Article III case or controversy, a concrete application of that authority has to be demonstrated, and he argued it just hasn't been under the theory of the plaintiff's case. Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts spent some time focusing on the court's standing standard, that injury claimed be, quote, certainly impending, and whether that was the proper formulation or whether the plaintiff's formulation of substantial risk fit the bill. Mr. Jaffer argued this was at best a narrow distinction, but did acknowledge that his position would expand a bit the standard for the imminence of alleged harm under the standing inquiry. Finally, there was some back and forth about the scope of the FISA court's review and whether its evaluation under the Fourth Amendment of applications targeting and minimization procedures suffices to provide a check on the overall statute. Justice Scalia seemed comfortable that it did, but the plaintiff's attorney argued that its authority was too limited, and they could not review the fundamental questions that the plaintiffs want answered here. Overall, this case appears likely to boil down to the justices' view of the reasonableness of plaintiff's speculation about government surveillance and the impact of the statute on their communications, as well as the justice's satisfaction that the FISA court will be an adequate check on government surveillance. Extending these plaintiffs' standing raises interesting questions about what other sorts of plaintiffs could have standing to sue on other sorts of statutes. It may be attractive to find standing here in the face of a few sympathetic plaintiffs and the justice's common sense reaction to what the government may be doing. But it may be hard to write an opinion that does that without dramatically expanding the test for standing. Several justices are obviously comfortable with the notion that not every harm has a judicially cognizable path for redress by possibly aggrieved individuals. Others, however, chafe at the notion that there is a question of constitutional law inaccessible to them or other courts. Also of note, this case is being litigated against the backdrop of ongoing legislative debate about reauthorizing the FISA amendments. In the past, these debates have been contentious and high profile. This cycle, however, the debate has flown below the radar, though the plaintiff groups in Clapper oppose reauthorization and make many of the same arguments they made in 2008 and in this case. The justices did not focus on the legislative battle, and it was largely missing from the briefing. Some might conclude that if relevant congressional oversight committees are not concerned about the statute's implementation, the courts should defer to the political process in this sensitive area of national security policy. Depending on how this case is decided, the standing analysis could have a lasting impact, however. A decision in Clapper is expected this term.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.